He is rapidly becoming a jailhouse lawyer. I'll survive inside, if I do, because of my brain, my knowledge of the law. They seek me out for legal advice, and they're all in awe of John. I only had one really bad moment. This one guy, a killer who literally ripped out the throat of the man he killed, walked over to me and I thought I'd had it. He was only interested in knowing about John, in finding out how he could get John to represent him. I get along fine with all of them. He glances at the locked gate behind me. They left it open when you went for your ID. I saw the coats here, the door open, and the thought of escaping flashed through my mind, but only for a minute. The trial just finished rankles Ted, and he wants to discuss it. He insists that Carol Durant was talked into her identification of him by the Salt Lake County detectives. Her original description of the man said he had dark brown eyes, mine are blue. She couldn't make up her mind about the mustache, and she said his hair was dark, greased back. She ID'd my car from a Polaroid, and the film was overexposed. It made the car look blue, and it's really tan. They showed her my pictures so many times, of course she recognized it. But in court, she couldn't even identify the man who picked her up and drove her to the police station. Jerry Thompson said he saw three pair of patent leather shoes in my closet. Why didn't he take a picture of them? Why didn't he pick them up for evidence? I've never owned patent leather shoes. Somebody said I wore black patent leather boots to church. Would I wear a maniac's costume to church? She never saw the crowbar. All she said she felt was a many-sided steel or iron tool when she grasped it from behind. She said it was over her head. Ted is as scornful of the psychologist, Al Carlisle, who is administering the test to him, as he is of the Utah detectives. Most of the tests are the standard ones that any psychology student is familiar with. The MMPI, Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Index, consisting of hundreds of questions that can be answered yes or no, with some deliberate lie questions repeated at intervals. I spotted the lie questions when I was a freshman in college, particularly, do you ever think about things too bad to talk about? The correct answer is yes. Everybody does, but many people write no. For Ted Bundy, that test was kindergarten stuff. The TAT, thematic aperception test. Look at a picture and tell a story from it. The Rorschach or inkblot test. Ted had administered these tests himself to patients. The Utah State Prison had its own psychological test, a series of adjectives where the subject underlines those that apply to his personality. He wants to know about my childhood, my family, my sex life, and I tell him what I can. He's happy and he says, do I want to see him again? So I tell him, okay, why not? We pause as another group moves through the hallway. The next time I meet him, he's smiling. He has a diagnosis. I am a passive-aggressive personality. The man is so pleased with himself, Anne, and he sits back waiting. He expects more from me. What does he want, a full confession? I say little during our visit. He has so much to get off his chest. And with the exception of visits from Sharon Auer and occasionally from O'Connell and Bruce Lubeck, his associate, Ted feels he has had no one to talk to who can communicate on his level. John thinks I should have gotten angry in court. He went to law school with Judge Hansen and he knows the man. I was sitting there just trying to understand the motivations behind the prosecutors and it was just too ridiculous to show emotion about, but John thinks I should have gotten mad. We talk about Sharon and Meg. He has known Sharon for more than a year, and she visits him faithfully every Wednesday and Sunday. Don't mention Sharon to Meg. Sharon's jealous of Meg, and Meg doesn't really know about Sharon. I promise that I won't involve myself in his complicated romantic life, and I marvel that he can keep two intense relationships going while he's locked up with a possible life sentence hanging over him. My mother's upset with Meg for telling the King County Police that I was illegitimate. The legitimacy of Ted's birth will eventually become the least of Louise Bundy's worries. This place. They've got everything they want in here. Drugs, speed. I won't do drugs. I'm not going to do the usual prison trip. I'm adjusting, and I want to work for prison reform. I'm innocent, but I can work from the inside. Ted still wants to write, and he feels that he can get writing out to me through Sharon. Sharon regularly carries papers, legal briefs in with her when she visits. She could carry his writing out and send it to me. I need $15,000 to hire private detectives. I think Carol Durant or someone close to her knew the man who attacked her. I need money to hire a team of independent psychologists to submit a report to the sentencing board. Everybody makes decisions about me, and I'm not even allowed to sit in on the meetings. I don't think you should try to publish anything before the 1st of June, I said. And Colorado, there's still Colorado.
I talked to Colorado. They have no claim on me.
What about those credit card slips in Colorado? He smiles.
It's not against the law to be in Colorado. Sure, I was there, but a lot of people go to Colorado.
I ask him if, when he writes, he will include a description of the murder cases, and he tells me that he believes those sensational cases will be essential to selling his book.
Sam Shepard was found innocent after years in prison, he recalls, and his book on an innocent man's ordeal sold.
Sitting there in that airless cubicle, I am once again on his side. He seems too frail, so beleaguered by forces over which he has no control. And yet the charisma is still there. I believe his position as a man who is, as he has been most of his life, in a situation that has no relevance to the real Ted inside. He remembers my world and politely asks how my house sale is going, how my children are. He begs me to stand by Meg, tells me how much he loves her and misses her. And then the guards are back. They tap him on the shoulder. They have given us an extra 15 minutes. He rises, hugs me again, kisses me on the cheek. They pat him down again. That's why they didn't search me. If I'd given him anything, they would find it before I left. The door slides open for me, and I pause for a minute, watching him as he is led back into the belly of the prison, dwarfed by the two guards.
Hey, lady, goddammit, watch out!
The door is automatically closing, and I leap forward just in time to escape being caught in its metal jaws. The guard stares at me as if I'm retarded. Lieutenant Tanner thanks me politely for coming, walks me to the prison's front door. And then I am outside again, past the Twin Towers, in my car and on the road back toward Salt Lake City. The wind has kicked up a dust storm, and the prison behind me is almost obliterated from view. Suddenly, there are red lights whirling atop a van in back of me. I have become paranoid in that hour and a half at Point of the Mountain, and I wonder, why are they chasing me? What did I do? The van pulls up closer and closer, and I prepare to pull over. And then it pulls off on a side road, its wail fading in the wind. I realize I am talking to myself. No. No, he couldn't have done it. He's been railroaded in there by public opinion. The man I just talked to is the same man I've always known. He has to be innocent. Driving toward the city, I pass the turnoffs for Midvale, for Murray, names that had never been anything before but places on a map, now the sites of two of the abductions. I pass commuters, bored with their daily routine, and I am so thankful to be free. I can go to my motel, have dinner with a friend, get on a plane and go back to Seattle. Ted can't. He is locked up with the rest of the fish. How could this happen to a young man with such a future ahead of him? I am so caught up in my reverie that I miss the turn to my motel and wander lost in the wide, clean, but confusing streets of Salt Lake City. It was that night, April 1st, 1976, when I had the dream. It was very frightening, jarring me awake in a strange room in a strange city. I found myself in a large parking lot with cars backing out and racing away. One of the cars ran over an infant, injuring it terribly, and I grabbed it up knowing it was up to me to save it. I had to get to a hospital, but no one would help. I carried the baby wrapped almost completely in a gray blanket into a car rental agency. They had plenty of cars, but they looked at the baby in my arms and refused to rent me one. I tried to get an ambulance, but the attendants turned away. Finally, in desperation, I found a wagon, a child's wagon, and I put the injured infant in it, pulling it behind me for miles until I found an emergency room. I carried the baby running up to the desk. The admitting nurse glanced at the bundle in my arms.
No, we will not treat it.
But it's still alive. It's going to die if you don't do something.
It's better. Let it die. It will do no one any good to treat it.
The nurse, the doctors, everyone turned and moved away from me and the bleeding baby.
and then I looked down at it. It was not an innocent baby. It was a demon. Even as I held it, it sunk its teeth into my hand and bit me. I did not have to be a Freudian scholar to understand my dream. It was all too clear. Had I been trying to save a monster? Trying to protect something or someone who was too dangerous and evil to survive?
Chapter 23. Something deep in my unconscious mind had surfaced, had told me forcefully that I perhaps believed that Ted Bundy was a killer. But I had made my commitment to keep in contact with him, no matter what the future would hold. I suspected that he did not feel things the way I did, but I could not believe that he was not laboring under a terrible weight. I felt that perhaps I might one day be the vehicle through which he could rid himself of that weight. If he would talk to me about what had happened, could reveal the facts still hidden, it would not only help him to receive the redemption he had alluded to in his poem, it could give some measure of relief, a finality to the parents and relatives who still waited to learn what had happened to their daughters. Oddly, I could never picture Ted as a murderer, never visualize what had happened. It was probably best that I couldn't. When I wrote to him, my letters had to be to the man I remembered, or I couldn't do it. Once before, Ted had called me when he was in the grip of some emotional anxiety. Although he had denied making that call to me on November 20th, 1974, I had seen the phone records. He had called that night, and I sensed that there would come a day when he would need me again. Something seemed to have gone so terribly wrong with Ted's mind, and I now suspected the sick part of him was capable of murder. If that was true, then he would need someone who could listen, who would not judge, but who might help to make his confessions easier. I felt that Ted might be able to expiate his guilt through his writing, and I continued to encourage him to write. He had asked me to call Meg. In our prison visit, he had told me, "I love Meg spiritually," and I wondered if that did not mean that Meg was caught up with a man who, even if he were not in prison, would never marry her. For her sake, I wrote to him, "My gut reaction to discussions we have had about Meg recently, and years ago, is that you do not ultimately see your future with her as much as you love her and as much history as you share with her. There is something missing. Something essential to a forever-after relationship. This, of course, is not something I would discuss with her, but I will encourage any effort she puts forth to become a complete person in her own right, so that she does not need any man quite as much as she needs you now." He seemed to agree, but there would be letters where he was terrified that he would lose her. Even so, there was Sharon, and I kept my promise not to discuss either woman with the other. I did call Meg, and she remembered me from that long-ago Christmas party. She seemed anxious to meet me again, and we set up an appointment to have dinner together. On April 7th, although he misstated the letter again as March 7th, 1976, I had a letter from Ted, the first since I'd returned from Utah. The small white envelopes furnished by the prison all had a pre-printed return address giving a post office box in Draper, Utah. And above that, Ted wrote, T.R. Bundy. Ted had pulled himself together now, an effort that would never fail to make me pause and consider the ability he had to do that. He could somehow manage to recoup and recover under such tremendous stress and adjust to each new situation. His letter was an apology in part, because he had usurped much of the conversation in our visit in prison. "I have developed a typical prisoner syndrome. The obsession with my legal case. The trial and the verdict live in me like some cerebral ulcer." He was writing many letters and observations in his cell, and commented that his left hand, he is left-handed, had become so strong that he broke his shoelaces without even trying. Ted commented on the link between us, a link that seemed to be growing stronger. "You've called it karma. It may be. Yet, whatever supernatural force guides our destinies, it has brought us together in some mind-expanding situations. I must believe this invisible hand will pour more chilled chablis for us in less treacherous, more tranquil times to come." Again, he urged me to take care of Meg for him, and he asked that I suggest to Meg that she read me some of the love poems he had sent to her.
He enclosed one of those poems, a poem he had printed on blue paper in the prison's printing facility. It ended, "I send you this kiss, deliver this body to hold. I sleep with you tonight with words of love untold. I would love you, if I might, with words that unfold these arms to press you tight." When I met Meg for dinner on April 30th, 1976, she carried with her a dozen or more poems, love poems from Ted. She had typed them carefully, with copies for herself and for Ted. They were romantic sonnets, something any woman in love would have clung to, and Meg was certainly a woman in love. Yet even as I read them, I was struck with the incongruity of the situation. This was the woman who had placed Ted in his present jeopardy, and I knew that Sharon Auer was also in love with him, Sharon, who thought Ted loved her. Meg wept as she read over the poems, pointing out particularly tender phrases to me. "I can't understand how he can forgive me after what I did to him, how he can write me poems like this." Meg slipped the poems back into the large manila envelope and glanced around the room. No one had noticed her tears. The heavyweight championship fight was on the television set above the bar, and everyone was staring at it.
"You know," she said softly, "I don't make friends easily. I had one boyfriend and one woman friend, and now I've really lost them both. I don't see Lynn anymore. I can't forgive her for making me doubt Ted, and I don't know when I'll ever see him again."
"What was there, Meg?" I asked. "What was there that made you go to the police? Was there anything besides Lynn's suspicions?" She shook her head.
"I can't tell you. I know you're writing a book. I hope you understand, but I just can't talk about it."
I didn't press her. I wasn't with her to try to squeeze information out of her. I was with her because Ted had asked me to stand by her. Pushing her would be too much like poking a creature with a stick, a creature already hurt. And yet Meg wanted information from me. She was jealous of Ted, even when he was locked up in the Utah State Prison. She wanted to know about Sharon. I told her truthfully that I really didn't know much about Sharon Auer. I didn't mention that I had talked to Sharon on the phone when I was in Salt Lake City, and that I'd heard Sharon's voice turn icy when I mentioned Meg. That was my first realization that Sharon was seemingly as unsure of Ted, as possessive as Meg was. Meg struck me as terribly vulnerable, and I wondered why Ted could not let her go. She was 31, and she wanted, needed a marriage, a chance to have the children she longed for before there was too great a gap between them and Leanne, before Meg was too old. Ted must have known that he would not be free for years, and yet he bound her to him through his poems, letters, calls. If anything, she loved him more than she ever had, and she was trying to cope with more guilt than she could bear. It was odd. Even as I mused about how Meg would survive with her complete dependence on Ted, I received a letter from him on May 17th, wherein he seemed terrified of losing her. He was sweating out his last 2 weeks before the June sentencing date, and that may have contributed to his anxiety. He seemed to feel that Meg was pulling away from him, and he asked me to go to her and plead his case. He had no real reason to doubt Meg's loyalty, but he sensed vibrations. "You are the only person whom I trust," he wrote, "who is both sensitive and in a position to approach Meg for me. I think it would be easier for Meg to express herself to you than to me." The letter ended with his opinions on the psychiatrists and psychologists who had spent 3 months examining him. "After conducting numerous tests and extensive examinations, they have found me normal and are deeply perplexed. Both of us know that none of us is normal. Perhaps what I should say is that they find no explanation to substantiate the verdict or other allegations. No seizures, no psychosis, no disassociative reaction, no unusual habits, opinions, emotions, or fears. Controlled, intelligent, but in no way crazy. The working theory is now that I have completely forgotten everything, a theory which is disproved by their own results. 'Very interesting,' they keep mumbling. I may have convinced one or two of them that I am innocent." I did call Meg on Ted's behalf and found that she was completely unchanged in her devotion to him. She had managed to tell him that in a 2-minute phone call to the prison, and urged me to assure him that she wasn't dating anyone else. He did not want to let her go, and Meg apparently did not want to leave him. On June 5th, Meg came to my home to spend the evening. She had just seen her parents off after a week-long visit, and was tense because they were not sympathetic about her continued allegiance to Ted. She was also apprehensive about Sharon, more aware of Sharon's relationship with Ted than he realized. I was in the middle of a situation that made me uneasy. I didn't want to cover for Ted if he was deluding Meg, but I didn't want to tell her about Sharon's twice-weekly visits to the Utah State Prison, either. I suspected that I was being subtly manipulated in keeping Meg bound to Ted. I wrote to him about Meg on June 6th. I think that she is aware of Sharon's relationship to you, but I stress that I really know nothing about it, and I don't know, and I don't want to know. When the time comes to thinking of everyday conflicts, you will have to get your act together. Ted's future was still in limbo. The sentencing on the Duranche kidnapping conviction, set for June 1st, had been postponed for 30 more days. It was conceivable, but not likely, that he would receive probation, or he could receive life in prison. Psychologists were still wrestling with his personality. I had received a phone call from Al Carlisle, the psychologist in charge of the report on Ted, one Sunday evening. He began abruptly, "Do you know Ted Bundy?" "Who wants to know?" I'd responded, knowing Ted Bundy was becoming something that one did not brag about. He had then identified himself, sounded a shy, diffident man. I told him only what I had seen. There was no point in my getting my dreams and fears into what was allegedly a rational psychological study. I explained that in all my contacts with Ted, I had found him normal, empathetic, friendly, gentle, and that was true. "Well," he said, "I've talked to a lot of people about him, and I've been surprised at the widely divergent opinions about him." I wanted to ask what they were, but it didn't seem the proper response. I waited. "I like him myself. I've spent about 12 hours with him, and I like him." Carlisle wanted copies of the two Ted letters which had accrued such undeserved fame, and I said I would send them, but only with Ted's permission. Ted gave that, and I mailed them to the prison psychologist. Ted wrote again on June 9th. With sentencing just around the corner, he had geared up for a fight. "The prospects are exciting." Ted found the psychological examinations malicious, slanted, and infernal. Harking back to his own psychology training, he felt prepared to deal with the questions that the doctors asked him and his friends, questions which suggested that he might be strange, homosexual, or deviant in his demands during sexual intercourse. He was angry because his examiners had told him that some of his friends had had negative things to say about him, but would not reveal the content of interviews or the names of friends. "I was aghast. Is this America? Am I to be attacked anonymously? I listed the names of several close friends, people who know me well. None had been contacted. Who are my detractors?" No response. He had received some answers. The testing team had reported to him that the nameless interviewees had indicated that he was changeable. "Well, sometimes you would appear happy, pleasant. Other times you would seem like a different person and unresponsive," they had told him. "They are trying so desperately to create a split personality," he wrote angrily. "I'll tear them apart." He was indeed looking forward to the hearing on his mental capabilities, positive that he could tear down all that the diagnostic team had constructed in the 3 months just past. Ted had begun to enter into the legal fight for his own freedom, and his participation would escalate over the years ahead. He was up, confident that his mind, his intelligence, could surpass whatever the psychiatric examination purported to reveal. I think he truly believed that through his own rhetoric, he would be free. Ted did make his statements to Judge Hansen. As he made his plea, he was the cocky, witty Ted, the man so removed from the facts that the whole situation was ridiculous. It was a posture that would irritate several judges and juries in his future court wranglings, but it was seemingly an attitude necessary for the survival of his ego. I have always felt that Ted would literally rather die than be humiliated, would face life in prison or the electric chair before humbling himself in any way. At the hearing, Ted was scornful as he attacked the arrests in August and October of 1975. He admitted to a certain strangeness of behavior when he'd been confronted by Sergeant Bob Hayward, but could see no connection with his actions, with the contents of his car, and the Durant kidnapping. He had had no alibi for the night of November 8, 1974, and he argued, "If I cannot remember precisely what occurred on a date which is now 18 1/2 months prior to my arrest for kidnapping, it is because my memory does not improve with time. It is safe to say what I was not doing, however. I was not having heart surgery, nor was I taking ballet lessons, nor was I in Mexico, nor was I abducting a complete stranger at gunpoint. There are just some things a person does not forget, and just some things a person is not inclined to do under any circumstances." Then Ted was sentenced on June 30th, despite his tearful plea that his being in prison would serve no purpose. "Someday, who knows when, 5 or 10 or more years in the future, when the time comes when I can leave, I suggest you ask yourself where we are, what's been accomplished, was the sacrifice of my life worth it all? Yes, I will be a candidate for rehabilitation, but not for what I have done, but for what the system has done to me." He drew a comparatively light sentence, 1 to 15 years. Because no other charges of such magnitude had been brought against him, he was sentenced under provisions for a lesser second-degree felony. All things being equal, he could hope to be paroled as quickly as 18 months hence. But of course, all things were not equal. The investigation into the murder of Karen Campbell in Aspen, Colorado was accelerating. Investigator Mike Fisher had the credit card slips, and he had received word from the FBI lab's criminalist, Bob Neal, that among the hairs found when Ted's Volkswagen was processed and vacuumed were hairs that were microscopically alike in class and characteristic to not one, but 3 of Bundy's suspected victims, Karen Campbell, Melissa Smith, and Carol Durant. Hairs are not as individual as fingerprints. Yet Bob Neal, an FBI crime lab expert for 2 decades, stated he had never found 3 victims' purported hairs in one spot before.
"The chances of 3 different hair samples being so microscopically alike and not belonging to the victims are 1 in 20,000. I've never seen anything like it."
One Washington detective mentioned to me that the crowbar found in Ted's car matched the depression in Karen Campbell's skull. There was said to be an eyewitness, the woman who had seen the strange young man in the second-floor corridor of the Wildwood Inn minutes before Karen vanished. The word among law enforcement networks was that the Colorado case was much stronger than the Utah kidnapping case had been. If Ted was aware of the burgeoning Colorado case, and I suspect he was still more caught up in the emotions that lingered after the sentencing in Utah when he wrote to me on July 2, 1976. That letter was classic, in that it was the evaluation by the subject himself, an honors psychology graduate, of the psychiatric evaluation done on him. The letter was typed on an ancient machine with letters clotted with ink. But Ted's pride in his hour-and-a-half dissection of the psychiatric evaluation transcended the blurred pages.
"I was whistling in the wind, yet, in a curious sort of way, I felt a deep sense of fulfillment. I felt relaxed but emphatic, controlled but sincere and filled with emotion. It didn't matter who was listening, although I desired each word to strike the judge as forcefully as possible. Briefly, all too briefly, I was myself again amongst free people, using all the skill I could muster, fighting the only way I know how, with words and logic. And all too briefly, I was testing the dream of being an attorney."
He knew he had lost. But he blamed that loss on the police, the prosecutors, the judge, on what he termed the weaknesses of men who were too timid, too blind, too frightened to accept the cruel deception of the state's case. The psychiatric diagnoses had concluded that Ted Bundy was not psychotic, neurotic, the victim of organic brain disease, alcoholic, addicted to drugs, suffering from a character disorder or amnesia, and was not a sexual deviant. Ted quoted Dr. Austin, the psychiatrist, the one member of the team who he had thought most forthright.
"I feel that Mr. Bundy is either a man who has no problems or is smart enough and clever enough to appear close to the edge of normal. Since it has been determined by the court that he is not telling the truth regarding the present crime, I seriously question if he can be expected to tell the truth regarding participation in any program or probation agreement. Ted's conclusion was that Judge Hansen had swayed the entire evaluation by his original verdict, and that the diagnostic team had merely groomed their report to match the verdict. Carlisle had evidently concluded that Ted was a private person, one not known intimately by others. When one tries to know him, he becomes evasive. "Anne, think of me as you know me," Ted wrote. "Yes, I am a private person, but so what? And the part about being someone incapable of being intimate is absurd." Ted's pain and hopelessness came through in the last paragraphs of that long, long letter. "I am exhausted. The bitter reality has dawned, but the full impact of my fate has not been fully understood. Since the sentence was handed down, the first flashes of intense anger and despair have grown out of the knowledge that Meg and I shall never have a life together. The most beautiful force in my life has been separated from me." He asked me to share the letter with Meg, explaining that it was the first he had written since being sentenced, and asked me to comfort her. "There can never be any goodbyes for Meg and I, but I weep bitterly to think that there can be no more hellos." I was mightily impressed by Ted's ability to think like a lawyer in the polished order of his evaluation. His IQ had been tested at the Utah State Prison and found to be 124, not on the genius level, about what a student in a four-year college needs to graduate, but he was clearly superior to the test results. My loyalties wavered once again. It would always be so. And yet, even as I read Ted's declaration of his great love for Meg, I was aware that he seemed to be able to dismiss his concurrent relationships with other women. If he could not be faithful to Meg, how could I fully believe in his steadfast love for her? It was so hard for me to know. Despite my dream, despite the bombardment of opinions from lawmen, there were still so many facets of his story that were hidden from me, and still that chance that Ted was being railroaded. If he was manipulating me, he was doing an excellent job of it. Chapter 24. While Ted had been sentenced in the Durranche kidnapping, it had been the most minor of the crimes he was suspected of. And although Colorado authorities seemed to be putting a case together in the Campbell slaying, Washington State detectives were supremely frustrated. In the fall of 1975, Captain Herb Swindler had been transferred out of the Seattle Police Crimes Against Persons Unit and became commander of the Georgetown precinct in the south end of Seattle. There were rumors that Herb's preoccupation with psychics and astrologers in all the occult possibilities in the mass killings had begun to annoy the brass. With the reassignment to Georgetown, Herb would be out of the missing girls' cases for all intents and purposes. His duties would involve supervising the uniformed contingent of patrolmen in his precinct now. It was still a position calling for a high-ranking officer and one with uncommon good sense, but Herb's contact with detectives would be minimal, and the hierarchy upstairs in the public safety building would no longer hear tales of Swindler's bizarre investigative techniques. It was not a slap in the face. It was more the gentle rapping of knuckles. Swindler had been the only detective who had believed that Kathy Parks of Oregon was part of the Seattle pattern, and he'd been right. It was September 1975 when he'd been transferred out of the probe, ironically only a few weeks before Ted's arrest. Swindler's replacement, Captain John Leach, is a tall, blonde veteran cop, a man my age, and a man of some brilliance. Herb had liked to talk over everything that was happening. Leach was as close-mouthed as a sphinx and leery of me. In time, he would come to regard me with a certain grudging trust and took delight in teasing me about my boyfriend, Ted. But in 1976, John Leach and I circled each other somewhat warily. I found him a solid administrator who left the detectives in his unit alone to do their work, a cerebral kind of policeman. I don't know what he thought of me, although he tended to view me as part of the media rather than an ex-cop myself. I liked him, but he intimidated me. He, on the other hand, was very concerned that I might be regarded as a police agent in the Ted Bundy transactions. He needn't have worried. It was a role I most assuredly did not want to play. I was still walking the tightrope between Ted and the detectives, a rope that seemed to wend over higher and higher precipices. It was imperative that I continue to write fact detective stories, and any breach of faith with a police agency would mean the end of that. Neither did I want to be disloyal to Ted, although it was becoming more and more difficult not to believe that Ted was the man the police sought. Nick Mackey, over in the county offices, had known me for so long that I wasn't much of a threat. During most of the spring and summer of 1976, we met sporadically to talk about Ted. Ted knew it because I continued to forward messages from Mackey. At times, he grew churlish about my suggestion that he talk to the King County commander, but he never seemed truly angry about it. Although Mackey never revealed to me exactly what the detectives had on Ted, he tried continually to convince me that they were right. I don't know how many times he asked me with some exasperation, "Come on, admit it. You really think he's guilty, don't you?" And I would always answer, "I don't know. I just don't know. Sometimes I'm sure he's guilty, and then again, sometimes I wonder." On two or three occasions, my discussions with Mackey continued through lunch and far into the afternoon. Both of us were searching for answers that seemed always just beyond reach. I was quite sure of one thing. After writing up at least a dozen cases in the Northwest dealing with mass killers of young women in the 8 years preceding, I felt that the Ted had souvenirs hidden someplace, that he had kept a trophy from each killing. "Nick, I think that somewhere he's hidden earrings, clothing, possibly even Polaroids, something from each girl. I've never found a case similar where the suspect didn't keep mementos."
"I agree, but where? We've been through the Rogers' rooming house, the attic, the garage, and we've dug up the garden. We didn't find anything."
Of course, the elder Bundys had absolutely refused to allow their Tacoma home to be searched, nor would they permit a search of the grounds of their A-frame cabin vacation home on Crescent Lake. Senior Deputy Prosecutor Phil Killian had advised Mackey that there was not sufficient probable cause to obtain a search warrant for those properties. His inability to search for physical evidence to tie Ted in with the Washington cases, particularly at the Crescent Lake location, tormented Mackey. I didn't blame him, but without a search warrant, anything detectives found would be considered fruit of the poison tree, that is, inadmissible as evidence in a court of law, because it would have been obtained illegally. If Keppel or Dunn or McChesney were to go to the A-frame cottage and find something like Georgianne Hawkins' purse or Janice Ott's bike or Linda Healy's turquoise rings, it would be absolutely useless, tainted evidence. I had had that concept hammered into my head when I'd taken a course entitled Arrest, Search, and Seizure. Mackey mused.
"We can't go, but I wish someone could, that someone could just bring us in one piece of physical evidence."
And indeed, that was the only way it would be admissible. If I myself were to search any private property Ted was known to frequent after this conversation with Nick, anything I found would be fruit of the poison tree. I would be an extension of the arm of the police department because I had never considered searching on my own. The detective's hands were tied. The rules of the justice system in criminal investigation are so intricate, and most of them seem to be weighted heavily on the side of the suspect. It was unlikely that Ted Bundy would ever be charged or tried in the Washington homicide cases. There was nothing more than the dozens of circumstances that seemed to defy probability. Months later, when Captain John Leach felt free to talk to me with cautious candor, he concurred that he felt the same way. It was his opinion that the only way Ted might be tried for the Washington cases would be if the 8 cases were combined.
"If all the known facts came out on all the girls up here, I think there would be a conviction. But that seems to be the only way."
And no defense attorney would allow the Northwest cases to be lumped together. John Henry Brown would fight like a tiger if such a suggestion arose. Chapter 25. Caught in the Utah State Prison, Ted's ego seemingly remained intact. Our letters continued in that odd intimacy that is sometimes maintained through the written word, an intimacy and occasionally an honesty that is more difficult to keep alive in a face-to-face situation. If I could manage to suspend disbelief, I could continue to support him, if not wholeheartedly, then through my letters. The truth was caught somewhere, suspended in an intricate cobweb of suspicion, denial, and continuing investigation. I kept in touch with Meg, too, and found her to be gathering new resolve. She signed up for some evening classes, started looking for a home to buy, and she was becoming increasingly suspicious of Ted's ties to Sharon Auer. When Louise Bundy returned from Ted's sentencing, she had made the tactical error of repeating over and over to Meg her feelings that Sharon was a lovely person. Meg had finally deduced that Sharon was much more to Ted than an errand girl. When I spoke to her in August 1976, Meg was vacillating between saying goodbye to Ted forever, not because of the charges against him, but because he had lied to her about Sharon, and continuing to support him with her love. She mailed him one letter to pave the way for a break, and then was instantly sorry.
"I've been rethinking it. Maybe I was too hasty."
Ted spent that summer in prison, becoming more acclimated to confinement. I didn't hear from him again until August 25th. I had suggested to him that I pass his letter on his feelings about the psychiatric report on to Nick Mackey, a suggestion that was not met with glee. Yet this letter, arriving 8 weeks after the outraged evaluation letter, seemed to reflect the emotions of a man who was getting it together again. He was pleased to note that he had a new typewriter, earned, he said, when he wrote his first writ after being moved into the general population of the prison.
"General population is the faceless mass of real prisoners we fish are always afraid were trying to rape us, and worse, steal our commissary. They were greatly overrated. They never steal commissary," Ted wrote.
Indeed, he was doing well among the general population. He had been afraid to move among these cons, cons for whom any man convicted of crimes against women or children is anathema, the lowest rung in prison hierarchy. Such men are often beaten, raped, or killed. But no one had threatened Ted, and he said he could move about the entire prison without fear because he had something of value to give the inmates of Point of the Mountain, legal advice. He was often stopped and asked to help other prisoners prepare their appeals for new trials. Just as he had told me during my visit when he was still a fish, he would survive because of his brain. Further, he was something of a celebrity, and his outspoken defense in his own legal encounters had impressed prison leaders. The old-timers made a point of being seen with Ted, of putting their stamp of approval on him.
"I think they also enjoy seeing a once-Republican, once-law student, one-time white middle-class member attack the system as vigorously as they think it deserves," he commented. "I keep in close touch with the blacks and the Chicanos, and my work for men in these groups has helped my image. One thing I have successfully avoided is the holy-than-thou, I'm so smart I shouldn't be here with you criminals image."
His days were spent working in the prison print shop, listening to other prisoners' grievances, and wishing I were not here. He seemed happy to report that Meg was becoming more independent, even though it meant she didn't write to him as often as before, but he was looking forward to a visit from her on August 28th. However, Ted had not become completely mellow. He launched into a harangue directed at Nick Mackey and other members of the law enforcement field. He did not want Mackey to read his letter on the psychiatric evaluation, although he forgave me for suggesting it.
"I think you should know where I stand on the subject of policemen in general, and Mackey in particular. Policemen have a job, a difficult job to do. But I am sorry, because I don't care one bit for the job they did on me, no matter how genuine the devotion to duty. I have a standing policy from this point forward never to talk to a law enforcement officer about anything except the time of day and the location of the toilet. Mackey has earned my particular disrespect. True, he may be a good cop, feeds his dog Alpo, and doesn't eat his young alive, but my empathy for him ends there."
Someday, Ted said, he would be interested to hear the monstrous theory held by the King County Police Department, but he was not presently interested in storybook fiction. He asked me to continue to stay in touch with Meg, and to
tell Mackey only that he has earned a special place in my heart, as I have probably earned one in his.
Ted's letters that summer and fall of 1976 range from the anger and humor of this one to requests for information to the blackest lines of depression. The mood swings given his circumstances were to be expected, His bid to remain free pending his appeal had been denied, and the Colorado murder charge hovered just ahead. There were several letters where he asked me to check out the credentials of Northwest reporters who were attempting to interview him. I tracked most of them to their sources and reported that they seemed to be essentially innocuous writers from small publications. Something happened to Ted's stability during the first week of September, something that seemed to make him despair completely. Reconstructing the time sequence later, I deduced that Meg had said something to him during their August 28th visit that made him think he had lost her forever. The letter Ted sent me on September 5th was typed on the cover from a pad of typewriter paper, and its contents seemed steeped in the bleakest loss of hope. It could not be interpreted as anything other than a suicide note, and it frightened me. Ted explained that the letter was like a call to the crisis clinic, but that there could be no reply.
I am not asking for help. I am saying goodbye.
He wrote that he could no longer struggle for justice, that he was not having just a bad day, but that he had reached the end of all hope, the darkening of all dreams. The letter as a whole, each sentence in it, could only mean one thing. Ted planned to kill himself.
What I'm experiencing now is an entirely new dimension of loneliness mixed with resignation and calm. Unlike times of low morale I have survived in the past, I know I will not wake up in the morning refreshed and revived. I will wake up knowing only what has to be done, if I have the courage.
As my eyes raced down the page, I felt the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. It might already be too late. He'd written this 3 days before. The last sentences were a plea to the world who believed him guilty of any number of terrible crimes against women.
Lastly, and most important, I want you to know, I want the whole world to know, that I am innocent. I have never hurt another human being in my life. God, please believe me.
Although he had said the letter could have no answer, I remembered that Ted and I both had been taught at the crisis clinic that any contact made by someone in emotional distress, any reaching out, must be regarded as a cry for help. Ted had written to me, and I had to assume that meant he wanted me to stop him from destroying himself. I called Bruce Cummins, our long-ago mentor at the clinic, and read him the letter. He agreed that I had to take some action. I called John O'Connell's office in Salt Lake City. It was either that or notify Warden Sam Smith's office in the prison, and Ted had better friends in his lawyer's office. I reached Bruce Lubeck and told him that I feared Ted was about to kill himself. He promised to go out to Point of the Mountain and see Ted. I don't know if he went or not. I wrote a special delivery letter, a letter full of hang-in-theres, and sent it, holding my breath for days, expecting to hear a news bulletin. It never came. Instead, on September 26th, Ted wrote me a letter that was a partial explanation. He referred obliquely to hanging himself, but assured me that he was
hanging in there with nothing but my soul, I will add to your relief.
Apparently, it was not my letter that had turned him around, but a session of handball which he'd found to be an effective method of catharsis. It, handball, has a curious way of draining the bitterness away. Or perhaps it's the body's way of asserting itself over the destructive impulses of the mind, temporarily mindless of the body's uncompromising, unquestioning, eternal desire to survive. The body may only appear as host to the brain, but the intellect, fragile and selfish, is no match for the imperative of life itself. Hanging around intangibly is better than being tangibly nothing at all. Ted apologized for alarming me. I wonder if he realized how very upset I had been to receive that suicide note, if he remembered how guilty I'd felt because I hadn't been able to save my own brother's life when he'd reached the point of suicidal thoughts. Ted had decided to live, and with this decision, his anger and bravado burst forth in his ensuing letters. Again and again, he castigated the police.
Police detectives are a curious breed. But one learns quickly that when they have something, they act first and talk later. I never underestimate the inventiveness and dangerousness of such men. Like wild animals, when cornered, they can become very unstable.
Ted had reason to fear the dangerousness of police detectives. On October 22nd, almost exactly a year since he had been charged in the Durant kidnapping case in Utah, he was formally charged with the murder of Karen Campbell in Pitkin County, Colorado. I suspect that he was as eager to confront his accusers as he told me he was. His strength in the face of attack seemed to be real, as it would always be. The overt challenges he could face. He was best on his feet, scornfully denying charges against him. However, it is possible that Ted had not planned to be around when those charges finally came down. On October 19th, Ted had not returned to his cell from the yard. Warden Sam Smith announced that Ted had been discovered behind a bush and that he'd had an escape kit on his person, a social security card, a sketch of a driver's license, road maps, and notes on airplane schedules. Ted had written that his pristine behavior had allowed him more freedom around the prison, and now there was speculation that with his job in the print shop, he might have intended to print up phony identification papers. He was immediately placed in solitary confinement. In retrospect, viewing Ted's propensity for escape that was to surface in the months ahead, it is likely that he had planned an escape from Point of the Mountain, an escape that was aborted. On October 26th, I received a letter from Sharon Auer, who enclosed a brief note that Ted had sent to her to send to me. Sharon was still very much a part of his life, even though his letters to me extolled no one but Meg. Sharon was horrified at the maximum security cell where Ted was being held, although her impressions of the whole were based on Ted's description of it as he was allowed no visitors. Ted had written to her that he envisioned his cell as something resembling a Mexican prison. 8 feet high, 10 feet long, 6 feet wide. 2 feet in from the front are steel bars running from floor to ceiling. A solid steel door, with only a peephole for the guard to look in, closes off the front of the cell. The walls have graffiti, vomit, and urine coating them. Ted's bed was a concrete slab with a thin mattress, and the only item of hope in the cell was a crucifix hanging over the wash basin. He could have nothing to read, but was allowed to receive letters. He would be there 15 days, and Sharon was angry that he had received this harshest punishment possible for such a minor infraction as having a social security card on his person. She wrote that she was trying to write him 3 or 4 letters a day. The bastards may not let me visit, but they're sure going to tire of carrying mail to him. Reading her letter, I was again bemused and somewhat dismayed at what the denouement might one day be when those two women who loved Ted realized they had been deluded into believing that each was the only one. And I made up the third corner of the three-woman network giving Ted emotional support. I had managed to remain relatively unscathed. Torn by conflicting feelings and doubts still, but I was not in love with Ted. Sharon and Meg were. Ted wrote to me from solitary confinement on Halloween. He said he had had only a woman's social security card and not the kind used for identification, and blamed Warden Smith for blowing the circumstances out of proportion. I never found out what woman's name was on that card. Ted was angry, but he was not chastened. Adversity of this kind only serves to make me stronger, especially when it is clear to me that it is designed to create the pressure some believe will shatter my normal facade. How absurd, said one prisoner when he heard of the decision to place me in isolation. They're trying to break you, Bundy. Yeah, they're just trying to break you. I couldn't have agreed with him more, but since there is nothing to break, I'll have to suffer instead. The fact that some persons continue to misjudge me has become almost humorous. Ted commented on the Colorado case only to the extent that he insisted he was innocent of any involvement. He hinted that he had documents that would destroy Colorado's case. The Colorado trial will mark the beginning of the end of a myth. He said he had sent me a note via Meg, which was a slip, because it had not been Meg who forwarded it, but Sharon. And he chided me gently for living in luxury in my new house, for writing to him on my new personalized stationery. Personalized stationery is one of the small but truly necessary luxuries of life. Ted was attempting to push my guilt buttons. I was free and living in splendor, and he was in the hole. I refused to take the bait and wrote back, You said you'd given the message for me to Meg, but it was Sharon who sent me one. You probably just misspoke yourself. Don't go getting the two of them confused or you'll be in hot water. While you're envying my security, remember, you have two members of the opposite sex in love with you, and I haven't got any. Fortunately, I've been so busy lately with work, housing, and the kids' problems, there hasn't been much time to ponder this glaring lack. I am still sleeping with my typewriter, and it's still cold, lumpy, and unresponsive. Ted's reply came after his extradition arraignment on the Colorado murder charge, an arraignment that took place on his 30th birthday. I had sent him two humorous birthday cards, explaining that Hallmark didn't put out a card specifically for his predicament. Hi there, happy 30th birthday and happy arraignment. He had chosen to view his situation with wry, angry humor, and I geared my responses to that. Ted wrote after the extradition hearing that he had drawn the largest crowd of reporters he'd seen in one place since his ordeal began, and he denigrated the press's sense of fair play and justice, since it has none. He assured me that the eyewitness in Aspen was of no consequence, since she had picked out his picture a full year after the Campbell disappearance. Although Ted's extradition arraignment on November 24, 1976 had drawn a flock of reporters, he was not the most famous prisoner in the Utah State Prison that week. It was a fellow convict, Gary Gilmore, a convicted murderer with a death wish, who made the cover of Newsweek on November 29th. Compared to Gary Gilmore, Ted was decidedly second-string news. It would not always be so. Gilmore was an habitual criminal who had shot two young men during robberies, and he had a kind of bitter mystique about him. He, too, was involved in a doomed romance with a woman who seemed as bedazzled and driven as Ted's Meg was. The tragic child woman, Nicole Barrett, who had entered into an abortive suicide pact with Gary Gilmore, reminded me of Meg and her obsession with her lover. But Ted apparently saw no correlation at all between his romance and Gilmore's and detested the other man for his manipulation of Nicole. He had studied Gary and Nicole when they met in the visitor's area. The Gilmore situation grows curiouser and curiouser. Have seen him on occasion in the visiting room with Nicole. I'll never forget the deep love and anguish in her eyes. Gilmore, however, is misguided, unstable, and selfish. The media preys on this Romeo and Juliet saga. Tragic. Irreconcilable. Nor did Ted have anything good to say about Gilmore's legal advisors. Ted had little time to ruminate on the saga of Gary and Nicole. He was busy reviewing and indexing 700 pages of testimony from the Durant trial, and at the same time studying Colorado criminal law. After reviewing the Utah trial, he could not see how the judge could have found him guilty, and he was sure that there would be no guilty verdict in Colorado. I feel like a general conducting a battle, not General Custer either, he wrote enthusiastically. Legally, I am on very solid ground. Ted never failed to comment on what was happening back in my world, even if it meant only a sentence or two at the end of his letters. This time he wrote, I am anxious that Cosmopolitan et al. Return payment so you'll be able to rent a helicopter and get me out of here. The prison maintains, falsely, that I had airline schedules. Can you imagine? If I were foolish enough to go to an airport, I certainly wouldn't give a damn which flight I jumped on as long as I was assured the plane could take off and land. Doing well, battling like hell. You know what it takes for the tough to get going. Love, Ted. The talk of escape, however flippant, had begun to flash a warning light on and off like a subliminal message on a television screen, hidden among Ted's discussions of legal battles. But then, all prisoners dream of escape, and all of them talk about it. The possibilities, the odds. A minuscule number actually try. Ted had mentioned that he would be having a change of scenery, and that meant that one day he would stop fighting extradition to Colorado, but he would do it in his own good time. He had much research to do first. There was no more money for lawyers, nothing more to be counted on from family and friends in Washington, and that meant he would be in the hands of public defenders. More and more, he was seizing his own legal destiny. Like the little red hen, he would do it himself. Almost from the moment I moved into my new home, leaving the sea and the wind to take over the little beach house we'd vacated, my writing fortunes took an upward turn. I had assignments from Cosmopolitan, Good Housekeeping, and Ladies' Home Journal. After years with the pulps, I'd finally broken into the slicks. Interestingly enough, all my assignments had to do with victims of violent crimes. The American public in 1976 had finally begun to show concern for the fate of crime victims. Too many people had become victims or knew victims. Because I'd been busy moving and meeting publishing deadlines, I had not written to Ted for 3 or 4 weeks, and I got a rather plaintively hostile letter from him in mid-December. Dear Anne, I surrender. Did I say something offensive? Worse yet, is my breath offensive? Have my letters been stolen by the CIA, and you think I don't write to you anymore, so you don't write to me? Am I too hopeless a case? Don't answer that. I can take it. Yes, sirree, never let it be said that I lost my cool just because my friends have forgotten me. It was not a happy season for Ted. For the first time, he was behind bars at Christmas time. Only a year before, we had sat together at the Brasserie Pittsburgh. It seemed that 20 years had passed. Ted's letter was his Christmas message, poems scrawled on the lined paper. This note must do as my Christmas card to you, a way of thanking you for the merriment you have brought into my life, not to mention the life-sustaining support. Now all I need is one of those quaint verses that all the store-bought cards have. May Santa's reindeer be so kind not to leave their droppings on your roof. It's here, don't pretend you couldn't tell. If you're not into Christmas, catch the first train to hell. So just tack up those house